Very much welcome, everybody. I'm delighted to see so many people here, which is a tribute to our speaker today, who I'll introduce in a moment. But it's good as we come towards the end of our pre-election programme to see turnouts like this, and delighted to see you all. I'm going to close the meeting, as I always do, at 2 o'clock exactly. That's why I'm starting slightly early, because I think we need to leave time after Sir Richard spoken for questions and comments. But can I again say welcome to you. Before I move on to today's meeting, can I just announce that our next meeting will take place in this room next Wednesday, when Jonathan Powell, the Prime Minister's Special Envoy to the Libyan Transition, as it's called, and was also the Chief British Negotiator on Northern Ireland from 1997 to 2007, and Chief of Staff, as we know, to Tony Blair from 1995 to 2007. He's going to give a lecture entitled From Northern Ireland to Libya, How to End Armed Conflicts. And I think that will be an interesting occasion, and I hope many of you will turn up. If you want to, let Jacqueline Jenks know as you leave today, so that she has some idea of the numbers who will be coming. That will be our last lunchtime meeting before the general election. We hope to resume our summer programme in May, but that may well depend on the result of the election and how long it takes to achieve a government and to get Parliament resumed. None of us can foretell that, so we won't come out with any particular dates and subjects at the moment, but as soon as we have some idea, we will of course let you know. And as always, thanks to those of you who have contributed to our running costs. We're very grateful. Anybody who'd like to contribute or renew their subscription from last year, particularly before we break for the election, could they talk to Jacqueline Jinks as you leave? But I am grateful for that. Today we've got, I think, a very apposite subject. Title is National Security, Current Threats, Hard Choices and Soft Options. And our speaker today is Sir Richard Dearlove, KCMG OBE, who is currently the Master of Pembroke College, Cambridge. As you know, he served as Chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service from August 1999 until his retirement in July 2004. And before that, for 5 years, he was the Director of Operations and from 1998, Assistant Chief. I've got a lot else I could tell you about him, but I'm sure he would agree those are the salient facts which make it so important that he is here to address this topic for us today. And I'm going to ask him to speak to us now. Sir Richard.
Michael, thank you very much. I hope everybody can hear me. If you have any problem at the back, you know, wave. But I think the amplification is okay. It's nearly 9 months since I spoke at RUSI and made a plea for proportionality in the UK's response to the threat of terrorism. And I'm very grateful to the Global Strategy Forum, who suggested that I give a follow-up to that talk. I think the questions are, do I stick by what I said then, or in the light of events, have I modified my views? And I'm not going to talk much, in fact, I'm not going to talk about cyber threats today, and I'm not going to talk about China, because I just don't think there's time to cover all of that ground. I'm going to look essentially at the issue of terrorism again, and also I want to talk a bit about Russia and Ukraine. Now, quite a lot has happened. Of course, the most striking terrorist event has been the Charlie Hebdo and related attacks in Paris. But there have been no terrorist deaths in that period here in the UK. Yards of newsprint has been devoted to Jihadi John and the three absconding teenage girls from Bethnal Green. And there's been extended debate in Parliament about the government's new counter-terrorist powers. And most recently, the ISC has exonerated GCHQ from acting illegally, as Snowden and his supporters had alleged, but recommended a revision and simplification of intercept legislation to lend more transparency and understanding to the way in which the powers of government are exercised in this sensitive and topical area. In addition, the behaviour of Russia in the Crimea and eastern Ukraine has reminded all of us forcibly that much of our national security agenda can be and is still set by the threatening behaviour of nation states. And it's not only sub-governmental organizations like Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, the Taliban, Boko Haram, and ISIS that are destabilizing the international situation. I've always said in talking about national security threats in a post-9/11 world that the sort of analysis that one has heard in the West about global threats was probably rather different from the way that the world was still being viewed in Moscow and Beijing. And a much more traditional nation-state view has prevailed there. And I think now we see a situation where this traditional view is reasserting itself and, of course, has considerable implications for our own assessment of national security and our defence policy needs. And I do think this actually is a very important and fundamental shift, because we have been through a period where we have thought and focused largely about, you know, new global threats. We have ignored some of the nation-state equation. And I think those of us who sort of recall circumstances at the end of the Cold War will remember the debates in Parliament in particular about the so-called peace dividend. And I remember arguing with the Treasury at the time when I was responsible for finances in MI6, when they were strongly advocating what they called the Dutch solution to national security. I must say that, you know, we have to sort of remember the perspective that covers this period, and I think we are moving into a period of significantly different conditions. The Charlie Hebdo attack was deeply shocking, but seemed to me to carry all the hallmarks of Al-Qaeda's strategy and thinking, in particular Bin Laden's replacement, Zawahiri. There's no question that recently ISIS had grabbed international attention and had displaced Al-Qaeda as the apparent vanguard of the extremist Islamist movement. The murder of the Charlie Hebdo team was designed to send a most dramatic and shocking message to the world by a choice of target as symbolic of Western cultural values as the Twin Towers were to capitalism. And it certainly worked as an act of media communication and is still doing so in the debate that has followed. It was quite clearly an assault on our values. And I think it's interesting to reflect that if you look at our statement of national security, which is published online, you look, for example, at the tasking of the security service, there is nothing in those documents which talks about defence of our values, which I think is an interesting side issue. Maybe they should be revised in that respect. The Charlie Hebdo attack underlines, I think, the cultural and social nature of the Islamist rejection of the rights and values of the liberal democratic state. And in so doing, it points towards the overwhelming case, in my view, for a social, cultural, and educational response in addition to the national security response. We tend to forget that the national security response is really only a preventive one, and it doesn't offer solutions to the fundamental problems which are or lie at the causes of this type of socio-religious terrorism. I think I should also add that the success of the attack was, in my view, a serious security failure by the French state. And I think I'm qualified in some respects to say that, being an enormous supporter of the French services and their effectiveness. But the fact is, the target was known, the threat was known, and the protection was in place, but proved to be thoroughly inadequate. I mean, the attack should have been stopped at a first or second line of defence. And the prevention of terrorism, which in the UK has hitherto been more successful, is actually about throttling the message that terrorists wish to send as much as it is about preventing an attack. And I think that, you know, we should all reflect very carefully on this issue of terrorism as a violent and extreme means of political communication. And for this reason, I remain deeply uncomfortable about the massive amount of coverage the story of Jihadi John has been given in the press and the Bethnal Green runaways. Now, of course, these stories have human interest aspects which are extremely powerful and seductive. But we do risk giving the subjects a type of iconic status, and there will be many confused and vulnerable young people reading these stories who will be yearning for similar levels of attention. Now, since I wrote that sentence, I was pleased to read Simon Cooper's article in the Weekend Financial Times supplement. And if you haven't seen it, it's last weekend's, I urge you to read it. It's headed, How Westerners Became PRs for Terror. And he makes the crucial point that terrorism is PR, and it is a form of communication, particularly through visual media, television or online visual media. And there's no question, as he says, that ISIS has become the new gold standard for terrorist PR. And he also refers to struggling Western media using terrorism to get clicks, and he uses the phrase, struggling Western politicians use terrorism to unite citizens behind them. And I think that's a very telling article. But just going back to the problem of these young people, I do sincerely hope that the communities from which these troubled young people come will face up to the fact that their children's actions are ultimately their and their family's responsibility. They cannot expect the police or the security service to have the capacity to act in loco parentis. What sort of discussion had taken place inside the girls' families about, for example, the struggle between Sunni and Shia Islam, about events in Syria, about Al-Qaeda, about the attitude of mainline Islam towards the violence practiced by ISIS? If the answer is none of them had been discussed, the families are certainly at fault for ignoring the very obvious crisis within their own religion. And it's absolutely clear to me that many young Muslims take a very strong interest in this crisis. So it should be, as it were, being articulated and talked about. But this brings me back to repeat my plea for proportionality and to emphasize the need to proceed with great care in making changes to the law to take account of the phenomenon of radicalization, and I'm making a distinction here between the phenomenon of radicalization and actual terrorism. It's a problem that certainly can and does engender high levels of anxiety, but in proportionate terms, it's a problem which, though it stretches the resources of the intelligence and security community, has so far been managed reasonably well. They are under pressure. They have great concerns about things going wrong and about being blamed for failure. And there's a lot of pressure on the security and intelligence services for this reason. But that isn't necessarily a reason, in my view, to make far-reaching changes in the law. To manage this problem, we need the cooperation, indeed we need the leadership of our own Muslim community, and we also need patience and staying power. And I think we have a tendency to be blown off course politically
and legally by incidents, some of which will be shocking and provocative in the extreme. But of course the nature of modern PR terrorism is to drive us towards the extreme in our response. The more serious danger from terrorism, in my view, is currently more latent than actual. And what I mean by this is that I think the thing that worries me more, and has always worried me more, is the possibility that the resources of a sophisticated nation state, let us say some of the nuclear weapons capability of Pakistan, are overrun by a group of Islamist extremists ready to act without any sense of moral or political restraint. In fact, this was one of Al-Qaeda's original ambitions, and we know very precisely that they tried to suborn Pakistani nuclear technicians. This is going back to the period after the invasion of Afghanistan. But this actually was thwarted successfully by intelligence operations. But the danger from ISIS, for example, is that it should gain sufficient political momentum that it aspires to control more than the conventional weapons arsenal it originally captured from the nascent Iraqi military. But at the moment, it doesn't look to me as though this is an advancing risk. But it cannot be entirely discounted. Now, I think it's this type of risk rather than the risk of radicalization which is a powerful argument for the government having enhanced powers. More so, as I said, than tracking radicalized youth. But these powers should be constrained and invoked sparingly. The ISC's recommendation to revise intercept legislation is, I think, a good one. The law needs greater clarity, and there also has to be greater public understanding of what the powers of government are and how, when, and why they should be used. I think it was the post-9/11 growth of intercept capability without proper debate or explanation, and this is particularly true of the US, it's not so true of the UK, that gave oxygen to Snowden's revelations. I would also recommend the creation of a new scrutiny body other than the ISC that could work within the ring of secrecy and provide assurance that the powers of intercept, when exercised, were appropriate to the management of the perceived threat. In fact, one of the problems with the current REAPER legislation is that its usage has been debased by excessive police and local authority usage. The intelligence and security service warrants have to be signed at a ministerial level or equivalent. Outside central government, REAPER authorizations are not subject to the same degree of rigorous scrutiny or control. Finally, let me say something about Russia and Ukraine. Now, if we had any remaining illusions about Putin's regime, they should have been dispelled by the assassination of Boris Nemtsov. However, I do believe that the West mishandled Ukraine. Ukraine's choice of the EU was always going to threaten fundamentally Putin's plans for Russian leadership of a Eurasian economic community. Quite apart from the emotional impact it would have on Russia's sense of national identity, a dialogue which had started before the crisis might have made it easier to handle. And of course, a dialogue about Ukraine's status as a hinge country between East and West. However, I'm not sort of making excuses for Putin's extraordinary subsequent behaviour. But expect to hear from Putin on the 9th of May about the renewed threat of fascism in Europe. Even in Cambridge, I've heard the fascist argument deployed to justify Putin's actions. And having spent several 9th of May's myself behind the Iron Curtain, when it existed, expect strong echoes of the Soviet anti-fascist rhetoric that the party used to rally nationalist sentiment. However, I do not subscribe to the idea of a return to the Cold War. But a Russia that does not respect the principles of European security is nonetheless a dangerous neighbour that must be deterred. And I think there is only one way to achieve this, which is unified Western diplomacy backed by an unequivocal expression of power. As Hollande and Merkel have discovered, talking to Russia without the willingness to imply the deployment of power as well, for example, by suggesting, threatening to help the Ukrainian military by arming them with more modern weapons, has little or no effect. Which brings me to the defence budget, and by implication, to the election. I'm shocked by the apparent reluctance of political leadership in this country not to make an absolutely clear commitment to increase defence spending to a real 2% of GDP, and in the medium to long term, perhaps to spend above that limit. Advocating increased defence spending at the expense of other areas, that it should be seen as politically toxic, is depressing and indeed symptomatic of a society whose politicians are completely obsessed with the domestic agenda. The fact is that Russia's aggressive behaviour in a European context is probably as important to each of us as the future of the health service. Now, explaining this to voters is very difficult indeed. But the soft option of not saying anything at all and hoping that we can muddle through, for example, by bumping up the defence budget by including the $3 billion spent on the intelligence and security agencies, is playing politics with our vital national interests. However, I'm pleased to see that more important voices than mine are expressing concern about this issue and calling for a clearer political lead from both of the main parties, and I think calling for a bit more courage when it comes to stating truths and talking about these political risks which are not, as it were, part of the domestic agenda. In conclusion, let me make one final point. And I think this is also sort of symptomatic of the conditions in which we live, of instant information, everything happening at high speed. One of the Cambridge scientists I know well talks about, you know, a web year being the equivalent of 2-3 months in length. And the plea I want to make is for strategic patience and staying power. Most international problems, particularly security problems, require a long-term commitment if they're to be managed successfully. There's no quick solution to the security problems that we face in Mali, Libya, northern Nigeria, Iraq, Afghanistan, or Ukraine, or Kosovo, for that matter. They all require a long-term commitment of resources. Otherwise, our opponents simply have to outwait us, as they are learning to do. Now, I think we all accept the loss of appetite for foreign military interventions. But part of the reason for a larger defence budget would be to put steel into our allies through sustained training and equipment programs so that they might fight their own battles effectively. And I think the other area is that as there seems to be a growing acceptance of the view that special forces do not count as boots on the ground, and we've seen this in a number of conflicts recently, we should be building up our special forces even further than they have been built already. And actually that's something I think the Obama administration late in the day has understood. The downside of the 24-hour news cycle is that we're hooked on instant and excessive coverage of every crisis, and political interest remains focused just as long as the media remains focused. As I said, we need to be much more deliberate about sticking with a problem for the long term. And I hope that our politicians will face up to the challenge of taking actions which are in the national interest but do carry political risk and are difficult to explain. And the various problems that I have listed or mentioned, most of them, I think each of them, is containable if we have the will and the patience and the means to contain them. But should they start linking and aggregating together, then we may find ourselves facing a much tougher set of larger problems which will threaten our vital national security interests and, as it were, oblige them to be dealt with at much higher cost in the medium term. Thank you very much.